Temptation by Mary Lou Williams, performing there with Buster Williams bass and Mickey Roker on drums, recorded in 1975. Mary Lou went on performing and composing well into her 60s. Looking back on her life, she said simply, "I did it, didn't I, through muck and mud." Well, we've made it through this Sunday morning via, I hope, less arduous and certainly less odorous circumstances. Many thanks to all the people, there are at least 16 of you so far, who've emailed to point out that the word Freude in Schiller's Ode to Joy was indeed replaced with Freiheit, freedom, in the performance in Berlin after the wall came down. Well, I wish you joy and freedom and lots of art to keep your brains alight in the week ahead.
Sunday Morning with Louise Trier is a perfectly normal production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
It's a totally different experience.
Totally unadulterated.
The excitement of it, the theatre of it.
People all over the UK are talking about it. A live concert every weekday night on BBC Radio 3.
This is a great step. The live broadcast is as close as it gets to the real thing.
With, on Friday, Bach's B minor Mass from St John's Smith Square. Radio 3, live in concert. Weeknights from 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
And now, Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Ruth Goodman is a social and domestic historian. She's advised organisations like the Globe Theatre and film companies like the one that put on Shakespeare in Love. You may well have seen her in a series of fascinating programmes for television like The Victorian Farm, Tales from the Green Valley and The Victorian Pharmacy, and more recently in The Edwardian Farm. I can't help feeling that this must have taken over your life for a while, your historian life.
It certainly did, yeah, absolutely. It was interesting, too, to plunge into different periods of history. My real love is the early modern, you know, Tudor and Stuart, and then suddenly having to find out all about the more modern stuff. And it does seem horribly modern to me, the Victorian Edwardian.
But you also fulfilled a rather important, and I imagine to you personally, quite essential role in showing what the ordinary role of women was.
I love that part of it. I really, really do. The ordinary, the nitty-gritty, the day-to-day, all those things that the grand histories just sort of brush over and forget about. You know, I think they're the things that really matter. Battles are all very well, but you can't have a battle unless you've got the food and the clothes and the cleaning and everything else sorted out. The battles and the kings and queens, they're the sort of floating on the top. The things that really make it happen, the things that drive history, are us, you know, the likes of you and me.
And given that you went back, I mean, you know, some 400 years in facing these various ways of life, you must have been quite astonished, even though you knew just how hard life was.
Oh, for gosh, I mean, there is nothing, well, farming in itself can be hard, even now. There is nothing like it. I mean, living without central heating, running water, just those. And then the outdoor farming life on top. And then the restricted diets at times. And the various vagaries of life when you never know quite what's going to be thrown at you as weather and disease hit your livestock or whatever. It is quite a thing.
But it must be very gratifying to find that really quite a large part of the population wanted to learn about this other way of life or this way of life in the past.
I was just so delighted. I mean, when we first got the thing saying how many people had been watching, it was just amazing. I had no idea there was so much interest out there. It's just lovely.
Do you think it is because, in a way, The kind of voyeuristic thing of thinking what life might have been like, you know, if you were born in a different age. But also that there is just a curiosity about the past and where we came from. And also it's learning, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there's an element of nostalgia in there too. And really, really nice. One of the things I really enjoy is hearing people say about, oh, we asked Granny about X or we're Grandad about that. And they said blah, blah, blah. You know, that whole business of getting families intergenerationally to talk to each other, discover that actually it was quite interesting, all that stuff. And I think, yes, there is that, oh, thank goodness we live now feeling. And there is also, at the same time, a sort of, oh, but it was quite nice back then in its own way, too. I think most of us are caught between the two, aren't we? Sort of a bit of nostalgia and also a bit of relief.
Yes, because with all of these luxuries comes pollution and noise.
Yeah,
and
everything's a two-edged sword, isn't it? And it's important to remember that in the past, you know, yeah, life was grim, but then it was also fun. It was always been a two-edged sword. Yeah. Everything has its up and its down.
Now, Ruth, having seen you in several of these programmes and seeing you even now, I realise that movement is quite important.
Oh, yes, I know. I'm jigging about like a crazy thing, aren't I?
And in fact, dance permeates quite a few of your choices.
It does. It really is the way I understand music. There's no doubt about it. I have real, real trouble listening to music without moving. I can't go to concerts. I can't. It's impossible. Everybody expects you to sit there behaving yourself all prim and proper. I can't do it.
So this first piece is in fact, a famous ballet.
Yeah. It's the first piece of classical music that really got into my head and stayed there. Yeah, I mean, I was quite young. My parents, I did ballet as a child, and my parents took me to the ballet, and it was just in there from that minute. It was the one tune I came out with, and it stayed there all my life.
I think sometimes, you know, we tend to sort of dismiss things which are light and frothy.
Yeah.
But that's to kind of rather minimise the skill that goes into it.
Yeah,
very
exactly.
Often, something which is rather simple but catchy and fun, there's a lot of skill that goes into writing that.
There is, isn't there? And it's such a cheeky, infectious piece. You can't help but keep humming it ages afterwards. As you say, really simple, but
And there are not that many composers. I mean, Rossini obviously springs to mind. Who can write really comic music?
It's true. It's a rare thing, isn't it?
And there are not that many comic scores. So I wouldn't decry it too much. That was Ferdinand Erhard, his music for La Female Garde, as arranged by John Lanchbery. That was the clog dance from Act One, and it was played appropriately by the Orchestra of the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, conducted by John Lanchbery. Did you know from a young age that you wanted to become a historian?
Not super young. So by about sort of 17, 18, I was talking along those lines. And my father sort of persuaded me out of it initially. And then it sort of came back and bit me later on, not many years later on. I didn't do a history degree. I did something else. And it was only afterwards, actually, when I got married, that the history bug really bit me. And first of all, in a sort of amateur capacity.
And do you think that this particular area, you know, social and domestic, which... Again, rather like you were talking about the role of women, it's not one that one thinks about a lot. But there is much more a vogue for it now, isn't there?
Because there is. It's much more fashionable.
Books by people like David Kynaston and people like that, which have very much homed in on how life was lived.
They have. They still tend to be more about the philosophy of it rather than about the practical nitty-gritty. But yes, it has become much, much more a mainstream subject for historians now than it was. I mean, when I was first sort of looking, there was almost nothing, almost nothing. 20, 25 years ago, it was really hard to find anything on the subject. There's a lot more out there now. But, you know, if you were to disappear down the library and hunt for a book on the history of washing up, I don't think you'd find it.
Well, this is your next project, clearly.
I need to write a book on the history of washing up. It's dead interesting.
And music, has that always been something that you've loved?
Yes, but through movement, through the dance. I mean, the ballet was seriously important to me as a child. I was taken along at the age of four because I'd been in a car accident and my leg had been smashed and physiotherapy wasn't working. Somebody suggested the ballet. And I am told that I utterly ignored every child in the room and was fixated upon the teacher. And indeed, my own memories are like that because I can't remember the other kids. I can only remember Miss Woods, who was in her 70s and was the most beautiful woman I had ever set eyes on. It was the way she moved. She was so graceful. I wanted to be her. And, you know, the two became so bound up so quickly. Music and dance, they are inseparable.
And Purcell, the next composer. And, of course, people have danced and sung his work at the same time.
Yeah.
But it is the dance again, isn't it? Even though this particular bit is called a symphony.
Yes, exactly. I mean... it's so in the shoulders. I can feel it here, this bit of my body. Yeah. Every bit of music hits me different. Opera is something completely different. It's usually much more about my legs for some reason. I don't know why. But every bit of music sort of hits a different part of me. And
this is the alternative to sinus seizure, you know, where you have colours of music. You have different parts of the anatomy.
Yeah, well, different ways of moving to it, yeah.
Well, I hope we'll work our way through the whole body before we get to the end. Gordon, we were talking about the history of washing up, and there we had part of the Fairy Queen. That was the symphony from Act 4 of Purcell's music. The Symphony of Harmony and Invention, the 16, directed by Harry Christophers. The next piece is...
Oh, this is real mood music, yes.
But this is one of the most famous ballet scores ever written.
It is.
And actually, it is fantastic. I mean, I never tire of hearing it because the orchestration is wonderful and the melodic invention is fantastic. But also, it couldn't be more programmatic.
Yeah. You know, if you ever want to have some sort of histrionic strop, this is the piece for you.
And do you know the ballet well?
I do, yes, yes. I was very, very, very privileged to see Nuria von Fontaine dance it when I was small.
We're talking about Romeo and Juliet by Prokofiev. And it is, apart from anything else, of course, such a timeless dramatic story, isn't it? It's West Side Story.
I know. People keep coming back to it again and again and again, don't they? It's such huge emotional stuff. And I agree with you, this piece just says it all exactly.
So which bit of this wonderful score have you chosen, Ruth?
Well, this is the Dance of the Knights, or the Entry of the Knights, and it's that bit of the Capulet Ball.
There's a lot of squaring up, I think.
It's the most histrionic piece of music I think I've ever heard.
Wonderfully kind of muscular, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I the other thing that always comes to mind when I'm listening to it is teenagers having to strop and banging doors behind them as their life is falling apart, you know. It's just so dramatic.
That was the Dance of the Knights from Romeo and Juliet Act 1 by Prokofiev, the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrei Previn. I'm very interested to know how you found dealing with some of the things you had to come to terms with. For example, in the Victorian farm, there was using coal.
Horrible fuel.
Yeah, and you did do quite a lot of the hard work, didn't you?
Yes, absolutely. Nobody's life was easy at that period, male or female.
And what kind of things did you discover through using that?
So much comes out. I mean, I have learned a lifelong hatred of coal as a fuel. It is dirty. It's heavy. That's an important thing. If you have to move it all, it's heavy. The filth is hard to explain to people who don't really remember working with it. And a lot of people who talk about coal fires with nostalgia are those who didn't do the cleaning because they were either children or they were, you know. The women of the household do not regret the loss of coal. It is filthy. Everything you do is filthy. The amount of housework doubles the minute you turn over to coal. It's a horrible fuel to work with. Smells horrible, tastes horrible. It taints the food. You have to sort of invent a new way of cooking so that no smoke touches it because it's just, yuck. Now you can hear my vehemence, the horridness of coal. And it changes so many other things. You have to change the way you do your laundry. You have to change the sorts of food you eat. It came to totally dominate domestic life, that change from an older wood fuel into coal.
Did you discover, when you were experimenting with food and how you could cook it and things that you really loved and which you've gone on using?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like?
Definitely, all sorts of things. I find it hard, actually, to unpick my modern cookery because so much of it is historical of one date or other. There's almost nothing modern in it. But it's not one particular date. I tend to mix, you know, at home, bits from this and bits from that tend to get all mixed together. I love the old flavours. I'm much more keen on using the whole of a beast and animal welfare as a result of doing historical stuff, because if you're going to kill an animal, you've got to eat it all. And if you're going to eat an animal, you ought to know how it's been kept and how it's been looked after. You ought to know the full process. It's not go around with your eyes closed.
Yes, because a lot of people would almost like to think that it's never killed at all, that it sort of somehow miraculously gets from a field to a supermarket shelf.
Absolutely. And I think that attitude allows you to turn a blind eye to disgusting practices. Whereas if you are more engaged with the process, I think you become quite concerned about animal welfare. Most people I know who are engaged and will pluck and gut and deal with all that sort of stuff are really quite strong on how the animals should be kept, how they should be slaughtered, about being decent to these creatures who then become our food.
Now, Ruth, you used a rather interesting expression in preparing the way for our next piece. You said that a certain rigidity is held in tension, which I think is rather interesting. Would you like to expound on that and tell us what it is, the piece?
Well, again, you know, it's sort of my response to it. I mean, the words, the sound structure is very repetitive, almost mechanical in a way, and yet you can always feel it's wanting to try and burst out. And certainly when I'm wanting to move to it, that's what it is. It's sort of like part of me wants to just keep doing the same thing to the music over and over again, very precisely the same thing.
Almost and then, mechanical.
Yes, exactly. Almost mechanical, like a machine. But there's always this feeling that somehow you've got to at some point sort of break it and go all fluid and floppy out of it.
Well, it's Philip Glass and Robert Wilson. It's Knee Play 5 from Einstein on the Beach. Did you first hear it just on a CD? Or?
I did, yes, I did. Yeah, my father plays a lot of music. He's much better at listening than I am. And I often get bits and bobs. And this is something that I did actually first hear by accident and then went and found myself later and listened to it properly.
These are the days my friends, and these are the days my friends, and 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 the days my some fish.
Cares and perplexities is ended, and the night is now upon us. The night should be a time of peace and tranquility, a time to relax and be calm. We have need of a soothing story to banish the disturbing thoughts of the day, to set at rest our troubled minds and put at ease our ruffled spirits. And what sort of story shall we hear? Ah, it will be a familiar story, a story that is so very, very old, and yet it is so new. It is the old, old story of love. Two lovers sat on a park bench with their bodies touching each other, holding hands in the moonlight. There was silence between them. So profound was their love for each other, they needed no words to express it. And so they sat in silence on a park bench with their bodies touching, holding hands in the moonlight. Finally, she spoke. "Do you love me, John?" she asked. "You know I love you, darling," he replied. "I love you more than tongue can tell. You are the light of my life, my sun, moon, and stars. You are my everything. Without you, I have no reason for being." Again, there was silence as the two lovers sat on a park bench, their bodies touching, holding hands in the moonlight. Once more, she spoke. "How much do you love me, John?" she asked. He answered, "How much do I love you? Count the stars in the sky. Measure the waters of the ocean with a teaspoon. Number the grains of sand on the seashore. Impossible, you say? Yes, and it is just as impossible for me to say how much I love you. My love for you is higher than the heavens, deeper than Hades, and broader than the earth. It has no limits, no bounds. Everything must have an ending except my love for you." There was more of silence as the two lovers sat on a park bench with their bodies touching, holding hands in the moonlight. Once more, her voice was heard. "Kiss me, John," she implored, and leaning over, he pressed his lips warmly to hers in fervent osculation.
I think this is what's very interesting about Glass and a lot of minimalist music, is that it is the antithesis of music up until that period, that, you know, to make a virtue out of repetition, if you like.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Of course, all music has repetition in it, and we need that to get hold of things. But to actually make such a kind of virtue out of repetition is in itself a kind of strange conundrum, which conflicts with the idea of development in earlier times.
I mean, from a sort of me dancing to it, that exactly what happens. I start off all very rigid, and then suddenly I'll just sort of like splurge, and then I come back to that same rigidity again, that same small stock of movements. It's always flowing between the two.
So maybe in a sense the repeated choral phrases kind of hold one together.
Mm.
That was from Philip Glass and Robert Wilson's Einstein on the Beach, and it was called Knee Play 5, the Philip Glass Ensemble, conducted by Michael Riesman. Well, we're getting down the body, actually. We're going to come back up again now, because that was knee music. And now I think corsets are in order.
Yes, they are. They are. You can't really listen to this without a corset on, as far as I'm concerned. One very, very heavily stiffened in whalebone. So that the only movement really is around your ankles.
And tell us what it is.
It's a lovely bit of Handel, the arrival of the Queen of Sheba. I like a lot of Handel. It just seems to sing.
It's very joyous.
It is very joyous. It is very uplifting. You do tend to get sort of swirled away in it.
And it is fascinating if you think about it, how certain pieces of Handel, I mean, obviously the Hallelujah Chorus and Things for Messiah, but also Zadok the Priest and the Queen of Sheba, have become kind of iconic.
Yes, you hear them everywhere, don't you? Absolutely everywhere.
Thank you. is infectious, that music. But you know, just going back to what we were saying about Philip Glass, it is fascinating how repetition is such an important constituent in music. And we heard it there, the same phrase played over and over. And we like it. You know? And I think that in a way what Glass does is take an aspect of that and just home right in on it.
Simplify it
and,
right
and narrow,
down.
Narrow the walls so that you're captured in this small space. But there we had the arrival of the Queen of Sheba from Solomon by Handel, the English concert conducted by Trevor Pinnock. Now, you've not mentioned yet, Ruth, that you live in with the bagpipes.
I do. They're fabulous. I love the bagpipes. Not the Scottish ones. Well, I don't mind the Scottish ones. They're fine. And for a while, my daughter did play the Scottish ones. But my husband is the main musician of the family, and he plays all sorts of various different bagpipes. Irish ones, the Ilian pipes, and French ones, and English Renaissance pipes. So, yes, we have a lot of bagpipe music in our house. It's great.
In fact, you met at a folk dance.
We did. Donkeys years ago, we met folk dancing. We did all our courting by dancing, which is terribly traditional. That's a terribly traditional word for a very traditional activity. But we did. He was the only bloke within a 300-mile radius, as far as I could find, who could dance. And he seemed to think the same about me. It was great.
And so how does that feed into the music we're going to hear next?
Well, this is Lunassa, who are very skillful, I think, and a really sort of quite mainstream folk at the moment. But, you know, I think you'll enjoy it.
And the piece is called The Floating Crowbar.
Mm.
Does that give us a clue?
I don't think it does, really. I mean, folk tune titles can be quite... and indeed, like most folk pieces, this is in fact one tune that then disappears into another one. They're usually played in sets. I don't think the title means a huge amount, frankly.
Thank you. It's quite extraordinary, that music, actually. I mean, it's incredibly skillful.
Yeah. It's a very different sort of style, too, isn't it? I mean, I know it plays into classical music all the time. There's sort of this constant crossover between the two, in and out and in and out. And
But the virtuosity, you know, between the pipes and the fiddle player was quite remarkable. And I remember recently, you know, there was a rather famous play called The Black Watch, which actually was about a Scottish regiment going to Iraq. I saw it at the Barbican. And at the very end, one of the soldiers, an actor, is actually an extremely good bagpipe player. And after sort of death and destruction and, you know, what's the point of it all sort of thing, this bagpiper just goes across the stage playing this fantastically beautiful lament. And it took the house down. You know, it's what music at that moment transformed what had been barrack room, a lot of swearing and, you know, but this transformed it into something of real pathos and tragedy.
I'm very, very fond of bagpipes. I mean, I think there's something about the way they get into your bones, that sort of drone shake thing that seems to sort of take you back into something very, very earthed and
vibrant. The drone is a kind of anchored. I mean, we were talking about the rigidity in the glass, that there is something which is constant.
Yes, and everything absolutely. Is moving just around. Holds you there with great power. I mean, and in so many different sort of formats, as you say, it can be incredibly full of pathos, but it can also be incredibly stirring. I mean, I know, you know, pipes and things, but I can't imagine any more sort of pick me up, hold my body and squeeze it than standing in a Breton street as the local bagad comes down and they've got Highland pipers because they like Highland pipes, and binews, which is their local form of bagpipe, and bombards, which are a sort of a really crude reed instrument, blaring away and everything's buzzing and it's not quite in tune, which actually adds to it. It makes it sort of a sort of dissonance that runs in and out, makes an extra throb.
Well, there's
lovely.
You know, funnily enough, that goes back, doesn't it, to sort of Shakespearean and medieval times and the bawdiness of creating sound and art. I mean, funnily enough, even our signature tune, which was inspired by a Chaucer series on Radio 3, and particularly the lines, "Vile brass emanating from the devil's arse." You know, but I mean, there are a lot of earthy sounds in real life kind of... And that ties in with a lot of the series that you did, that, you know, getting down to mucking out and...
Yeah,
you
know, the getting the basics, down and dirty.
Well, that was The Floating Crowbar, I think probably just like the sound of that title, don't you, by Lou Nasser. Now, Ruth Goodman, there is actually, in my mind, quite a strong connection between that piece and the next one, in that the virtuosic fiddle player is important in both.
I mean, I don't know, but it seems to me when I'm listening to this that Paganini must have spent hours and hours and hours listening to Jewish folk musicians. It just sounds exactly like that sort of fiddle playing that you hear in Eastern Europe.
Well, he might well have done that, because since it's rumoured he sold his soul to the devil, he didn't need to spend hours practising.
I mean, I think this is real headbanging music too. You know, it's sort of like when you were a kid and you stood there in the heavy metal thing, what the heck am I doing here? This is the real thing. This is the one you want to sort of stand up and shake and scream to.
Thank you. You know, when you're watching sort of Wimbledon or Grand Slam tennis and one of those great top five players does a shot that's just impossible and they laugh and they say, no. And actually, listening to that with that technique, that's what I was thinking. Honest. No, come on, you can't be playing this at this speed.
It's incredible, isn't it? Absolutely incredible.
Itzhak Perlman was playing the Caprice No. 5 in A minor from the 24 Caprices, Opus 1 of Paganini. Well, we're going to end, Ruth Goodman, with more ballet music and one of the great ballet scores again. We've heard the Romeo and Juliet from Prokofiev, now his Russian compatriot, Stravinsky. How strange that that period, Tchaikovsky, Prokofiev, Stravinsky, produced really, in my view, the greatest ballet scores of all time. Really.
It is quite incredible, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Such a lot of talent in one little area. One little part of art all coming together. Does that again and again, doesn't it? History of art. Wherever you look, you get these little concentrations where suddenly the right people come together and the talent just...
Whew. Yeah. And so this is the Firebird, from which you've chosen what?
The Princess's Round. I never know the names of these pieces. It always sound a bit odd. But this is sort of something very different from the Paganini, something so ethereal.
Thank you.
Well, that was rather a peaceful siesta-like conclusion after all your frenetic activity, Ruth.
Ethereal, yes. Something to breathe.
That was The Princess's Round from The Firebird by Stravinsky, the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Well, thank you very much, Ruth Goodman, for introducing us to all this music which you didn't have on the Victorian or Edwardian farm. And we look forward to Volume 1 of The History of Washing Up very soon.
Excellent. I'll put you down for the first copy. Thank you so much.
Ruth Goodman was talking to Michael Barclay. Next Sunday at the same time, Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the filmmaker, writer and playwright Mike Lee. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and today's edition was produced by Sarah Cropper.
Classical music in concert every Sunday afternoon. The Sunday concert, brand new to BBC Radio 3, begins with Nielsen, Walton and Vaughan Williams from Belfast, introduced by John Toll.
It's a programme that has lyricism at its very heart. For the first Sunday concert, join me, John Toll, this afternoon from 2, here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, news in a moment, and after that, and before the Sunday concert, there's the early music show. Catherine Bott will be talking to the Danish harpsichordist Lars Ulrik Mortensen, talking about his role as artistic director of Concerto Copenhagen, which celebrates its 20th anniversary this year. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock, and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, has said his party will block the government's planned changes to the NHS in England unless there are what he called substantial changes. The reform bill, which is on pause in Parliament, would cut management and give GPs more control over budgets. Mr Clegg said the Liberal Democrats must show that they were a moderating influence on the Conservatives. The Chancellor, George Osborne, said he and the Prime Minister also wanted changes to the bill. The Labour leader, Ed Miliband, has said the Liberal Democrats should leave the coalition if they aren't happy with its policies. He said the party was being led by the nose by the Conservatives. At least 10 people have died in fighting between Muslims and Christians in Cairo, with more than 180 others injured. The violence is reported to have begun when Muslims accused Christians of detaining a woman who'd converted to Islam. The Egyptian Prime Minister, Essam Sharaf, has cancelled a visit to the Gulf to hold an emergency cabinet meeting. Reports from Syria say the army and the police are keeping up pressure on anti-government protesters. In Homs, people have reported house-to-house arrests. In the southern town of Tufas, near Daraa, it's said that tanks have arrived and gunfire has been heard. The Pentagon now believes that Osama bin Laden was in active control of al-Qaeda from his hideout in Pakistan. A Pentagon source said the compound where he was killed was a command and control centre. The four men in charge of MG Rover, when it collapsed, have agreed with the government not to take any directorships for between 3 and 6 years. The move follows an investigation into the company, which went bust in 2005. The men, known as the Phoenix Four, took £42 million out of MG Rover after buying it for £10 in the year 2000. And the weather, there'll be scattered showers across much of the United Kingdom today, although southeast England should stay dry. Temperatures will stay around 16 Celsius, but feeling warmer in the southeast. That's the BBC News and Weather at 1:02. And we come now to the second of this week's early music shows. Here's Catherine Bott.
Hello. On today's programme, we're going to hear music recorded over the past 20 years by a group now regarded as one of the best period instrument ensembles in Europe. It's known informally as COCO, Concerto Copenhagen. Shortly, I'll be chatting to COCO's current artistic director, the harpsichordist Lars Ulrik Mortensen. But before that, let's hear the band in action. Thanks to our colleagues in Danish radio, we have access to a 20th anniversary CD they produced. And this bit of Telemann comes from a recording of their first public concert, given in Copenhagen's Church of Holmen in January 1991.
Thank you.
opening movement of Telemann's Concerto for Two Oboes, Three Trumpets, Timpani, Strings and Continuo, recorded in January 1991, part of the first public concert given by Concerto Copenhagen, directed then by Jaap ter Linden. And by the miracles of long-distance technology, I'm joined now from a studio in Denmark by Coco's current artistic director, Lars Ulrik Mortensen. Lars Ulrik, welcome to the Early Music Show at a distance.
Thank you very much.
Let's set out what the orchestra is all about, because my producer has found a marvellous quote from you which describes the ensemble's raison d'être. Apparently, you said, "We play music of long ago in order not to create a museum, but to create the exact opposite, a very contemporary here and now experience." Would you still go along with that?
Yeah, that sounds like me.
You've been the artistic director since 1999, so that's 12 years. What can you tell me about the group's early years?
Well, the reason that a bunch of specialised early music musicians 20 years ago decided to form a historically informed orchestra was quite simply that no such thing, perhaps surprisingly, existed in Denmark. And the initiators felt, rightly of course, that there was a huge gap to be filled in trying to build up an orchestra who would play music which we thought we knew, with a different sound, on different instruments, and with a completely different philosophy. Of course, there were huge organizational difficulties. Basically, there was no organization. There were huge financing possibilities, and there was also a lot of stops and starts in order to try and establish what is important to any ensemble, namely the sort of the core group of players. The first artistic director was Andrew Manzi. What Andrew did, of course, was bringing the entire amount of his impeccable musicianship, plus his not only his international standing, but also his international experience. And that really brought the orchestra much, much further forward than we could have managed, or that the orchestra could have managed, with somebody of a lesser standing.
Well, we've already heard music from the group's first public concert. Sounds pretty good. Was it well received and an instant Scandinavian